Now that the school year is officially underway, families are getting a clearer picture of where students are thriving and where they might need a little extra support. It's the perfect time to reinforce what they're learning in class and build confidence along the way. That's where IXL comes in. IXL is an award-winning online learning platform that helps kids truly understand their schoolwork. Whether they're building math confidence, strengthening reading and writing skills, or reviewing science concepts, from pre-K through 12th grade, IXL offers personalized interactive learning that adapts to each child's unique level and pace. IXL supports classroom learning by providing personalized practice that aligns with what students are already studying. It's proven to improve achievement, with results seen in all 50 states. Plus, one subscription covers everything for all the kids in your home, making it a time-saving and cost-effective choice. It's a resource trusted nationwide, and IXL is used in 96 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. Listeners of this podcast can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXLLearning.com/audio. Visit IXLLearning.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price. I've always dreamed of being able to order my coffee in Italian like a local, instead of just pointing at the menu and hoping for the best. There's something about speaking another language with real confidence that opens up a whole new world of experiences. That's why I'm so excited about Rosetta Stone Sapphire. It's their biggest launch in over a decade. It takes that research-backed method we all know and trust and adds fresh, cutting-edge features that make it easier than ever to go from knowing a few phrases to speaking naturally about the topics you actually care about. What I love is that you aren't just memorizing vocabulary lists. You learn entirely in your new language through visuals and audio, just like you did as a kid. One of my favorite new features is chat missions. It turns conversation practice into a game, putting you in real-world scenarios, like ordering at a restaurant or asking for directions, and giving you missions to complete. You get real-time feedback along the way, so you build that confidence before you ever have to use your skills in the real world. If you want to take your language skills to the next level, don't wait to try Rosetta Stone Sapphire. Listeners of this podcast can get 20% off their Rosetta Stone Sapphire subscription when they sign up today. This gets you access to Rosetta Stone Sapphire in 25 languages. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10 to redeem your 20% off. That's rosettastone.com/rs10.
Late drama in the Lindsay Clancy trial. The jury, with another question for the court, saying one juror is refusing to follow the judge's orders. Pentagon spokesperson Sean Parnell is Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's top choice to be the new Secretary of the Army. We're going to tell you what we know about him. And Representative James Walkinshaw joins the takeout to discuss accusations from a whistleblower about dangers surrounding mail-in ballots for the upcoming midterm elections. Hello, I'm Nancy Cordes, once again holding down the fort for Major Garrett. Welcome to The Takeout. Tension in the jury room in the Lindsay Clancy trial today. Late this afternoon, the foreperson sent out a question saying that a lone juror is refusing to follow the judge's instructions when it comes to the burden of proof. The judge then called each juror to the bench individually and spoke to them and instructed them in open court about the level of proof the prosecution needs to establish in order to convict Clancy for the killing of her three young children. The judge also described matters of the law these jurors must follow.
I want to remind you that you are required to follow my instructions on the law as I gave them to you, all right? I also want to, at this point, go over the instruction that I gave you about reasonable doubt. All right? And so, reasonable doubt. The burden is on the Commonwealth to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant is guilty of the charges made against her.
The judge then sent the jury back to deliberate before eventually excusing them for the day. We start off with CBS News correspondent Chanel Call, who joins us, as always, from outside the courthouse to break down these really dramatic moments from today. Chanel, What more do we know, if anything, about the issue with this one juror?
Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, look, there have been so many twists and turns in this trial. Here is yet another one, Nancy. Defense attorney Kevin Reddington today asking the judge to remove and replace a juror because he says the foreperson delivered a note to all the parties saying that one juror essentially wasn't following the judge's instruction when it comes to the burden of proof. And that's important, Nancy, because the thing about this case is in Massachusetts, according to state law, the burden of proof here is on the prosecutors, right? So Kevin Reddington actually doesn't need to prove that Lindsay Clancy was suffering from postpartum psychosis the night that she killed her three young children. He just needs to essentially put in reasonable doubt that she wasn't completely of sound mind, which is what the prosecutors here are arguing. So he obviously is concerned that this one juror, for this particular reason, may be causing this deadlock to be prolonged. Again, a very highly dramatic moment. Kevin Reddington, very lively, very angry, his face even turning red. Take a listen.
The court has an instruction from the foreperson of that juror that's been working for a week now, saying that there's one juror who refuses to listen to the law that you've given him or her on reasonable doubt. And I suggest respectfully that the soft instruction that you gave them saying at the sidebar, can you listen to the law as I instruct you, does not focus on the issue. It is the question is not sufficient enough. It does not allow any foundation for a motion to remove the juror who refuses to accept your instructions on the law, on reasonable doubt.
We have the note from the jury. There's no way to determine what the deliberations are, who's correct, who's incorrect, nor should we attempt to, because that's part of deliberations. I think what Your Honor has done by asking each juror if they're able to follow the law and then giving a general instruction on reasonable doubt is appropriate.
So here's what's going to happen next. Prosecutors after that moment, by the way, Nancy, objected to that. And then the judge rejected that that motion by Kevin Reddington. So he allowed jurors to be recessed for the day and said deliberations would continue at 9 o'clock this morning. But just a couple of moments ago, as he always does, Kevin Reddington spoke to the media as he was leaving court behind us here. And he spoke about that motion. And he said what's going to happen tomorrow morning is the judge is going to question that juror in open court. He said that would likely not be something that would happen in sidebar. And now I'm sure you're familiar with that word, which is that when sidebar happens, there is this noise that comes on. We can't hear the conversation that's going on between the judge and the attorneys on both sides. But this, he says, is going to happen in open court, possibly, so we could get a better understanding of what the issue here is with that one juror.
Fascinating. Every day, a new wrinkle. Chanel Call outside the courthouse. Thank you so much. I want to go now to CBS News legal contributor and federal criminal defense attorney Caroline Polisi to help us break this down. Okay, Caroline, what exactly does it mean when you have a juror who isn't following the law, according to the other jury members, when it comes to reasonable doubt?
Well, the short answer is we don't really know what it means yet. And that's why you heard earlier today the judge engaged in a small voir dire of each of the jurors, asking them whether or not they could follow the law. So the issue here is if there really is one juror in that jury that says, look, I don't care what the judge says. I don't care what the law says. There's no way I am going to vote one way or the other on this case because that's just how I feel. Well, that's improper, and that would be a cause to remove that juror and then to appoint one of those many alternates that we see. And that's really what Kevin Reddington wants because his assumption is, I believe, that it's 11 to 1 in his client's favor. That is, that there are 11 jurors who believe that Lindsay Clancy should be held not criminally responsible by reason of mental disease or defect. And then there's this one one holdout who refuses to go along with that, so essentially blocking unanimity and making a mistrial. It sounds like tomorrow the judge will dig a little deeper into this specific issue with respect to that one juror to satisfy himself. Because if it is the case that the juror actually does understand the law and simply doesn't agree with the other 11 jurors, well, then that's perfectly fine. That's how the law is set up and that's how the system works. And then a mistrial would be declared. So I think we have to figure out whether or not it's a conscious decision not to follow the instructions, or whether or not it's a genuinely held belief that they are following the instructions and their belief is just different from the other 11 jurors.
I guess we do know more than we knew yesterday, right? Because we knew they were deadlocked, but we had no idea what the breakdown was. Perhaps it was 6-6. Now we know that there is this one holdout and the other 11, at least based on what we know, seem to be on the same page.
Yeah, I mean, this is incredibly fascinating information. You know, if you had asked me this time last night, I said I would have said, and I think I did say, we're barreling towards a mistrial. It doesn't seem like we're going to get to unanimity. This bombshell today, right at the end, you know, leads me to believe that there is a potential that this jury reaches a verdict after all of these, going back to the judge these multiple times and the judge telling them to continue to deliberate, because it does sound like there's just that one juror. So, you know, we'll see what happens tomorrow.
Why do you think the judge didn't just appoint an alternate today?
Well, because that's not really his. I mean, it's a big deal to remove a juror, right? I mean, he would need to really investigate the issue to his satisfaction, such that he felt that the juror was not fit to serve. Clearly, I mean, each one of those jurors answered his questions today and said that they could follow the law. So if it's just an issue of clarity on the law, on what is reasonable doubt, some clarification as to that, well, that's a different story than actually being, unable to or unwilling to follow the law. So I think he did exactly what should have been done, pending further review tomorrow.
Fascinating. I guess tomorrow's going to be a pivotal day. Caroline Polisi, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Senior officials tell CBS News that Chief Pentagon spokesperson Sean Parnell is Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's top choice to serve as the next Secretary of the Army. For months, Hegseth clashed with Dan Driscoll, who left the post this week. Parnell is a decorated Afghan war veteran, and a former Republican Senate candidate. And back in 2021, his estranged wife testified under oath that Parnell was abusive towards her, including in one incident where he allegedly choked her. Parnell has always denied any wrongdoing. He's also taken an adversarial approach to the media. Parnell has stood behind limiting the press's access to the Pentagon and recently called the publication of leaked material in the Washington Post a crime. Let's turn now to talk about all of this with CBS News senior White House correspondent Weijia Jiang. Okay, Weijia, Vice President J.D. Vance held his first briefing at the White House since Caroline Levitt left as press secretary, and you asked him about Driscoll's departure. What did he say?
Nancy, I did, and that is because Driscoll and Vance have a close relationship. They were roommates at one point in law school. He was a close advisor to the vice president. So if anybody knows about Driscoll and his concerns, it would be Vance. And we know that one reason why Driscoll left was because he was worried that Secretary Hegseth's firings and sort of approach to the Army did not line up with his goals. And reportedly, he told administration officials that all of these generals and other top officials being let go were standing in the way of his goals for the Army. It's a concern that is shared with other Republican lawmakers who have been quite vocal about this. So I asked the vice president if he, too, had some of these worries.
Okay. Do you share any of the concerns of Secretary Driscoll and several Republican lawmakers about the current state of the Army, specifically about the departure of so many generals and other top officials?
Well, first of all, look, Dan is obviously a very good friend of mine. I think he was a great Secretary of the Army. Pete is also a very good friend of mine, and I think he's an amazing Secretary of War. And, fundamentally, there are a lot of issues where I agree with Pete on. The issue where I'm in the most strident agreement with Pete is that we needed to have a culture shift at the Department of War.
So the vice president seemed to side with Hegseth in talking about these departures, later saying that Hegseth wanted to bring the spirit of war fighting back to the Pentagon, and we are seeing that play out in various ways, Nancy.
Really political answer there. I know there were also a lot of questions, Weija, about Iran, how long the war is going to last, how long gas prices are going to remain elevated. What did he say about that?
Well, Nancy, the most remarkable thing he said about the war was that he didn't believe that we were engaged in one. He said that's not what he would call it, because there is no major combat operation. He says right now there is no shooting going on. Of course, this comes after days of back and forth missile strikes between the U.S. and Iran. And as President Trump warns that an even bigger attack could be on the horizon. In fact, the president himself in recent days has called this a war. So it's not a small thing that the vice president is contradicting that, but he's trying to downplay the conflict. He also says that there is no global energy crisis, even though, you know, allies and many countries have held emergency meetings to try to deal with the shortage of oil going through the Strait of Hormuz because it is driving up the global oil price. So, you know, heading towards the midterms, being one of the chief spokespeople for the Republicans right now in messaging, it makes sense that he is trying to, you know, frame this in a way that it's sort of no big deal. It could be a lot worse, he says, if President Trump were not in charge, Nancy.
Diesel is hitting a new record high for the year just this week. Weija Jiang, thanks so much. For more on the Iran war, let's turn to CBS News foreign policy and national security contributor. That's retired Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster. He, of course, served as the national security advisor during President Trump's first term. H.R., so good to see you. I want to ask you about a story that CBS News broke late last night. We obtained an email that showed that the Pentagon last month told personnel to stop calling the Iran war Operation Epic Fury. The Pentagon says that that operation officially ended back in May. Can you explain why it would have been so important to the Pentagon to reinforce to military members that it's not Epic Fury anymore?
Hey, Nancy, great to be with you. I think at the time it had a lot to do with the War Powers Act and the requirement to get congressional approval at that point. But also, hey, I'm pretty glad about it because, you know, I think what's in a name, you might say, but I think the name should convey your intentions. It's not Epic Fury, certainly at the Iranian people. It's fury against the regime. So, you know, hey, when we went into the city of Talafra in 2006 with the 3rd Cavalry Regiment, 2005 to 2006, we named our operation Restoring Rights, you know, to the people. The previous operation in that city had been called Black Typhoon. Now, I mean, of course, that doesn't mean that the operation applied firepower with less discrimination, but I think, you know, the name does kind of matter. So I'm glad to see Epic Fury sunsetted.
Along those lines, you heard Weija say that in the briefing today, Vice President Vance said he wouldn't call the conflict with Iran a war. Of course, we hear the president calling it a war all the time. What would you call it?
I'd call it a war, Nancy. And I think what he's missing is maybe the opportunity to make a case. I think that the administration should make at every turn, and they have made this case, you know, many times in the past, is that, hey, this isn't a new war. This has been a 47-year-long war that the Islamic Republic of Iran has been waging, you know, against the great Satan, the United States, you know, Israel, what they call the cancerous boil, their Arab neighbors. And over those many years, those almost five decades, we've had this mantra of de-escalation, which has allowed the Iranian regime really to escalate on their own terms with impunity as they use these terrorist and proxy forces. So I think you're better off to call it a war and to recognize that this war, in my view, what was necessary because of that huge capacity that Iran was building up with this missile drone strike complex, which would serve as well to be a shield behind which they would pursue the most destructive weapons on Earth.
Earlier, I mentioned that Sean Parnell is Hegseth's top choice right now to be Army Secretary. Do you think that Sean Parnell has the management experience to fill that role?
Well, you know, I'm not the best judge of that, but I do think that there are big parts of the Army that resemble a big business, right? The contract and the procurement part of this. And I think this is where the Pentagon's actually making some headway these days. So you want somebody with a lot of management experience. But you know what you really need more than anything, Nancy? You need somebody who can make the case for the Army and for the resources the Army needs. Because I'll tell you, the Army is too small, in my view. The Army has to address this bow wave of deferred modernization. And of course, you're going to get the Army that the American people and the representatives in Congress are willing to pay for. That's why it's important to have a Secretary of the Army who has a great deal of credibility and a great deal of persuasive ability, not only with Congress, but also, you know, with the press, who is an important bridge to the American public. And I think those are areas, you know, where he might struggle, although I'd wish him the best if he's confirmed, because the Army needs an effective leader at this moment.
Do you think he can get confirmed?
I'm not the best guy to answer that. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. There are a few of these confirmations, were surprising to me, you know, earlier. So who knows?
Okay, time will tell. H.R. McMaster, thank you so much. Appreciate your insight.
Thanks, Nancy.
Still to come on The Takeout, the whistleblower inside the U.S. Postal Service who has grave concerns about a new system for handling vote by mail. Virginia Democratic Congressman James Walkinshaw joins The Takeout to discuss. Also, why the Justice Department charged an ICE officer who shot an immigrant in Minnesota. Plus, mortgage rates hit a high for the year and gas prices remain above $4 a gallon. We're going to check in on the state of the economy when The Takeout returns in 90 seconds. Welcome back to The Takeout. A whistleblower at the U.S. Postal Service is warning that a new mail-in ballot system could create major problems and prevent millions of Americans from receiving their ballots at all. The whistleblower is accusing USPS of rushing to launch a, quote, risky and haphazard portal to screen ballots. It's part of President Trump's restrictive mail-in voting plan, which remains in legal limbo just 2 months before the elections. Democratic Congressman from Virginia, James Walkinshaw, joins me now to discuss. Congressman Walkinshaw also serves on the House Oversight Committee. Congressman, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So who did this whistleblower initially reach out to, and what exactly are they alleging?
The whistleblower reached out to the Senate House and Government Affairs Committee and the House Oversight Committee and shared their deep concerns with, A, the Postal Service's decision to continue trying to implement this system despite a court injunction saying that they couldn't, and B, the, I won't even say likelihood, the certainty that this system would fail and reject ballots from Americans who are legally eligible to vote by mail.
And that's because the way the system is being set up in a very small amount of time is that if it sort of spot checks information that it's getting from a state about who is eligible to vote, and it's got one big batch, and there is even one barcode for one person that is incorrect, the entire batch gets held up, right?
That's right. It's an enormously complex logistical, organizational, and technical challenge to pull this off. It requires every state to put a new barcode on their absentee ballot envelopes that would mesh with the Postal Service's system so they could scan that barcode. If one element was wrong, potentially an entire batch of ballots could be rejected. That means service members serving overseas don't get the ballot they deserve. Elderly folks who can't go to the polling place don't get the ballot they deserve, and more.
So has USPS answered any of your questions about what exactly is going on here?
They have not provided substantive answers to the technical questions about their ability to pull this off. They do claim that they legally can continue to put the system together while they're awaiting the final court rulings. That's a new position for them. They had stopped working on this system because of the court injunction. For some reason, they restarted. I want to know why they restarted. Did they get a call from the White House pressuring them to restart this work?
And all of this is incredibly time sensitive because, for example, North Carolina ballots, they start going out tomorrow, right?
That's right. That's right. Look, anyone who's been involved in election administration knows it is impossible to create this kind of system right before an election without creating massive disruption and chaos, which I think is what Donald Trump wants.
Now, it's important to note that this system only goes into effect if a judge paves the way for President Trump's executive order to be followed. So what happens if a judge allows it to go forward, let's say, 1 month before Election Day, when you've already got some states sending out mail-in ballots and others that aren't?
I fear that millions of Americans could be disenfranchised, including service members who are overseas today's rural communities, older folks, folks with disabilities who can't get to their local polling place could have their mail-in ballot illegally rejected.
While I have you here, I want to ask you about another topic because you do sit on the oversight committee. Leon Black, yeah. He is the billionaire, former associate, longtime friend of Jeffrey Epstein. He was set to appear before the committee today. Instead, he is suing the panel. Can you explain what is going on there?
Well, his lawsuit is laughable. Look, we issued a bipartisan subpoena to Leon Black to get him to come in and answer questions he refused to answer when he last came before us. Leon Black paid Jeffrey Epstein more than $160 million. They were close friends. He's faced credible allegations of sexual abuse from some of the women in Epstein's orbit, and he entered into non-disclosure agreements with some of those women. We want to understand the nature of those agreements. He's going to come before us and answer questions whether he knows it or not.
Very quickly, you just got back to Washington. Congress was gone for the month of August, but you found out you're not going to be here for very long because the session is being restricted to a couple of weeks, and then the House Speaker is letting everyone go all the way until Election Day. Were you surprised by that?
I wasn't surprised. Look, I think Speaker Johnson recognizes that when the Republicans are here in Washington, they spend more time fighting amongst each other and don't have real solutions for the American people. Look, I think it's a shame. Gas prices are at record high. Grocery prices are skyrocketing. The illegal war rages. Congress should be asserting its constitutional authorities with respect to those issues. We should be working for the American people to help them in this time of crisis. Instead, the Republicans are sending us back on vacation.
Congressman James Walkinshaw of Virginia, thanks so much. Appreciate you being with us. Up next, recent polling has Iowa's race for governor in a dead heat. In Iowa, Republican candidate Zach Lane joins me to discuss the state of his campaign. You're watching The Takeout. Stick around. Welcome back to The Takeout. Democrats have not occupied the governor's mansion in Iowa since 2011. But a new Emerson poll reveals that the race is in a dead heat. The poll finds businessman and Republican Zach Lane trailing the Democratic candidate and state auditor Rob Sand by 3 points. Zach Lane joins me now. Mr. Lane, thank you so much for being with us. For folks who don't know, you are a businessman. You founded a private school, and you surprised a lot of GOP officials earlier this summer when you defeated the Trump-backed candidate, Congressman Randy Feenstra. How do you explain that victory?
You know, I think it goes back to just being on the ground, meeting with people. I think we did probably 50 town halls during the primary, and the first poll had us at 1% when we announced we were the last candidate to get in the race in November. But by the end of the primary, we were seeing town halls with 100 to 300 people showing up at each one of these in all corners of the state. And we were bringing a different message about keeping our kids in the state, saving family farms, making public education number one in the nation again, and stopping the cancer crisis that Iowa's facing. So I think it's really been about the message.
Iowa has not elected a Democrat to the governor's role in nearly two decades. And yet this Emerson poll has you trailing your Democratic opponent, Iowa State Auditor Rob Sand. What does that tell you about the mood of the electorate in your state right now?
You know, I think the big thing to take away here is that since we won the primary, the first poll had us down maybe 10 points. My opponent is one of the most well-funded people to run for office in Iowa's history. I think he spent likely around $15 million since that time, and the lead has been cut by 70%. I think what we're seeing is that there is frustration, but the frustration needs to be properly aimed. You know, Iowa's recently ranked as the number one most affordable state in the country. We have a lot of work to do in different areas. But I think people like good governance. They like to see politicians and leaders that will take their concerns seriously and really put them forward. And that's what we've been doing. We've been talking about things that, frankly, Republicans haven't been talking about for a very long time. And I think that's a lot of why our message is cutting through and cutting through some of the frustration, because voters see, I feel the frustration too. And so we are really connecting on the ground.
You know, when you talk about that frustration, one of the things that the poll found is that there's a lot of frustration, especially among farmers in Iowa, about President Trump's tariffs, about the war with Iran that has driven fuel prices way up. How do you address that frustration as a candidate? And do you support President Trump's tariffs?
Well, you know, I think there's a place in the economy and throughout the history of our country for tariffs. There has been a place for a very long time. Properly placing them, I think, is the right way to do it. Now, look, I'm as governor, I don't have a foreign policy here. But what I can tell you is that I've been watching for a very long time on the ground in our state as prices have continued to rise for farmers year after year. The commodity prices will be flat or even go down while the price of their inputs continues to go up. I've been calling for antitrust suits against these companies that continue to consolidate and remove competition for our farmers. Really, that's the long-term thing that we have been fighting on the state. And I believe farmers understand that. You know, we were the first candidate to really give that a voice, I believe. And I believe farmers can see that we're taking it very seriously. We're going to pull every lever we can on the state side to make farmers have the opportunity to make more money, make life more affordable. And I think that is resonating. And people can see it's a genuine message that they've been waiting for somebody to take up.
What's your message to President Trump when it comes to the war, for example? You know, there have been new strikes this week. It doesn't look like oil prices are going to be coming down significantly anytime soon.
You know, I think we have to look at what can we do on the state level. And that's why I'm focused on, you know, how can we lower taxes for Iowans, especially for Iowans during times that we are seeing higher prices on fuel and things like that. We are looking very hard at how can we solve these problems for the people in the state. You know, as I said, we don't have a foreign policy as governor. You know, there's things that we can do on the state level that I believe will make life better and more affordable for people, especially for our farmers. I mean, look, we're going into harvest season. We operate our family farm today. We're feeling the squeeze, but long-term trajectory, long-term focus is what I think really matters here. How do we bring more competition to our farmers? How do we allow them to keep more of what they're earning so their kids can stay on the farm? That's really been a pinnacle point of my campaign. It's going to continue that way.
I saw that one of the things you're pushing for is a pause in data center construction. That's something that we've heard from Democratic and Republican candidates this cycle. How long of a pause do you think is necessary, and what for?
Yeah, you know, I think in Iowa, this is a county level decision. However, what we're seeing is that we've seen these projects being approved and they've not been negotiated properly. Really, what we're seeing is tremendous amounts of tax breaks, which these companies do not need. And I believe they're coming to the table saying they don't want anymore. They're willing to pay their fair share. But when something's happening at a breakneck speed, the responsible thing to do is say, let's pause, set the rules of the game, make sure that we're advocating properly on behalf of the citizens. And in Iowa's governor, I think my role is very simple. No tax incentives. You're going to pay your fair share. Make sure you're paying for the electricity. You're not going to raise the rates on consumers in the state of Iowa. And then how are you going to benefit the communities long term? Because that's really what this is about. And I think there are ways to do that. My job as governor is to be the chief negotiator for the state of Iowa and then allow counties to make the decision. What would they like to add to that to make sure the county is seeing a benefit for the citizens of the community? Lowering taxes is going to be one of those things that we can use these funds for. And I think there's a big opportunity there.
Zach Lane, Republican candidate for Iowa governor. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you very much.
And coming up next, a check-in on the state of the U.S. economy. Former Trump economic advisor Stephen Moore joins me to discuss. You're watching The Takeout. Welcome back to The Takeout. Here's a look at what else we're watching this evening. The Justice Department has charged an ICE officer with lying to federal investigators. Christian Castro shot a Venezuelan immigrant in the leg back in January following an altercation at a traffic stop in Minnesota, just 1 week after the killing of Renee Good. Castro is accused of shooting the man when he reached his home in front of his family and then lying under oath about what happened. Castro had been detained since May when Minnesota issued an arrest warrant, but he was released last week. Texas's Governor Abbott says he is weighing Minnesota's extradition request. Author, journalist, and women's advocate Gloria Steinem has died. Her family said she died peacefully last night at her home in New York City, surrounded by those who loved her. As a journalist, she uncovered the rough conditions for women involved with Hugh Hefner's Playboy. She also co-founded Ms. Magazine, which was the first major publication owned, run, and written by women. She was a longtime advocate for the Women's Equal Rights Amendment and reproductive rights. Hillary Clinton told CBS today that she was, quote, one of the architects of the entire structure of women's equality. Gloria Steinem was 92 years old. As we near the midterms, we're hearing two different realities when it comes to the economy. The markets are near record highs, was another great day today, but there are other troubling realities. Mortgage rates hit a new high for 2026, rising to 6.71%. That's the highest level we've seen since July of 2025. And of course, gas prices remain above $4 a gallon. 1 year ago, the price was nearly a dollar lower. Joining us now to discuss all of this is former Trump economic advisor Stephen Moore. He's now the co-founder of Unleash Prosperity and a senior fellow with the America First Policy Institute. Stephen, so glad that you could join us today. I want to start with oil prices, which are once again climbing to near $100 a barrel. Diesel just hit its highest level for the year, which means that the cost to deliver everything is going to go up. What does this mean for inflation, especially at a time when inflation is already outpacing wage growth?
Yeah, it's the first thing, Nancy, that I look at as an economist in the morning is what's happened to the global oil price. And it was it had fallen to 80. I think now it's above 90 again. And so that is a negative thing, no question about it, because obviously when the oil price rises, so does the price you pay at the pump. And other things, you know, rise in accordance, like food prices, manufacturing goods, because everything is derivative of energy. So it's not a good sign that we're looking at, you know, $90 plus oil right now. It's so frustrating for me as an economist because the world is awash in oil. It's just that you have these choke points in the Middle East, obviously, in the Strait of Hormuz, where the oil isn't flowing. And that has driven up. It's like a big tax on the world economy when you see high oil prices, although the economy, even though the prices have remained very high. I have an Audi. I use diesel in my car. I had to pay $100 yesterday to fill my tank. That was quite an eye opener. But the economy itself, despite that, is still doing, I'd say I give the economy a B. It's doing pretty well.
I want to ask you about another measure in the economy that caught our attention, mortgage data. It shows that the average rate for a 30-year fixed is at its highest level since last June. Obviously, that discourages people from selling the house they've got, buying a new one, taking on that new mortgage rate. It's also a discouragement to first-time home buyers. Experts are saying that this problem in particular could stick with us for a while because of rising Treasury yields. So do you agree with them, and how do you turn that around?
Well, it is a tough problem. I mean, you know, my wife and I were really fortunate back in around 2020, 2021. We got our mortgage at 3%, you know, and I'm looking now at those 6.9% rates or 6.8, whatever it is. I mean, so of course, you know, a higher mortgage rate makes it much harder, especially for young new home buyers to buy a house. And that's a real problem for the economy, no question about it. But again, I would sort of put that number in perspective because, you know, I said I got a mortgage for 3%. When I graduated from college, now I'm 66 years old, but the mortgage rates were like 16%, not 6%, 6 or 7. So, you know, they're certainly high, and it does make it more expensive for people to buy a house and get a loan. But in historical perspective, a 7% mortgage rate is about average of what we've seen over the last 50 years. I do expect, like, the most important thing to bring the mortgage rate down is to get inflation down. I do think with Kevin Warsh as the Fed chairman, he is really dedicated to getting inflation back down to 2%. We're running about 3.5% now. And if the inflation rate comes down, I guarantee you, Nancy, you're going to see the mortgage rate come down too.
We've just got about 30 seconds, but I was surprised to hear Vice President Vance say today that he wants the mortgage rates to be brought down by the Fed, despite the fact inflation is not at 2%, job growth is slowing down. Is that the right call for Vance to make?
I didn't see exactly what J.D. Vance said, so I can't really comment on it. I'll just simply say the job of the Fed is to keep the dollar strong and stable. That is I've known Kevin Warsh for years. That is exactly what he intends to do. And so we all want the mortgage rate to fall. And as the dollar stabilizes and we see inflation come down, and that's going to be a little tough in the short term because of those high oil prices, then yes, we're going to see that mortgage rate come down as well.
Stephen Moore, thanks so much for breaking it down with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And coming up, J.D. Vance and Tucker Carlson, friends. Will that end up causing problems for the vice president, especially if he decides to run for president himself? Our political panel is going to weigh in on that and much more. You're watching The Takeout. Stick around. Welcome back to The Takeout. As we mentioned earlier, the House of Representatives returned to Washington at the beginning of this week, and they'll be leaving Washington sooner than we even thought. House Republican leaders announced today the last 2 weeks of the September session have been canceled. I guess they got enough done. Lawmakers will now remain in session through September 17th and then depart until after the midterms. Let's bring in our political panel to discuss. Democratic strategist and CBS News political contributor Joel Payne and Republican strategist and former counsel to Vice President Vance, Sean Cooksey. Good to see you both.
Great to be here.
Sean, Congress always has a lighter year when it's an election year, but this is especially light.
Well, look, I think Speaker Johnson and the Republican leaders have decided, at least at this stage, to quit while they're ahead. They passed a CR this week, funded the government past the midterms. They have got the Democrats to form something of a circular firing squad around some of their moderate members. I think they've decided that the best use of their time is to send their members back, campaign, start messaging on their accomplishments of the last 2 years, and try to keep the majority.
Joel, I think the House Speaker said this week that this was the most productive Congress ever.
People like to say that a lot. I remember I worked, I think it was the 110th with Harry Reid. We said we were the most productive Congress ever. Listen, I think the broader problem that Johnson and congressional Republicans have is that the American people have not felt like they have been prioritized in this session of Congress. And look, they can point to the big, beautiful bill. They can point to these CRs and some of these, you know, funding bills, et cetera. But those things have prioritized President Trump's interest and the people around him and his allies and, you know, keeping money in the pockets of the wealthy. In fact, transferring $1 trillion of wealth from working people to the wealthiest people. I haven't really, looked out for those folks who were counting on Donald Trump to prioritize him and his agenda. And I think they're going to feel the wrath of that as they lead up to the election this November.
Sean, you've obviously worked very closely with Vice President Vance. And I want to play you a little bit of what he had to say today when he was asked about his good friend, Tucker Carlson. Take a listen. We'll talk about it.
Tucker is a friend of mine. Tucker is a friend despite the fact that we disagree on a number of things. And I'm not going to play the game where I throw friends under the bus because I have political disagreements with them. I think that is a terrible place for the United States to go. And if you have a disagreement with somebody politically, even over a deeply held issue, you should still be friends with that person because the whole republic depends on people of different perspectives being able to talk to one another.
Obviously, Tucker Carlson is not the figurehead of the GOP that he once was when he was the king of Fox News, and he has put forth much more controversial views in recent years. So how harmful could this friendship be to Vance, if at all, if he decides to run for president?
I mean, I don't think it's going to be harmful at all. I think the vice president gave the exact right answer to this question. He first noted very clearly that he has political disagreements with Tucker. I mean, we've seen just recently Tucker come out in favor of the Democratic nominee for the Senate race in Michigan against Mike Rogers. Vice president's very clear. He's supporting Mike Rogers for that seat. At the same time, I think the vice president's making a hugely important point about the culture and about political disagreement and the ability to maintain friendships and family members and neighbors that you can disagree with politically, but still remain cordial with, still maintain a relationship with. And I think he's right to resist what is frankly kind of a cancel culture style pressure to get him to disavow or disassociate from someone who is his personal friend. I think that's the exact right thing for him to do.
Joel, how successful are these attempts to associate politicians with any one controversial person, whether it's Hassan Piker or Tucker Carlson?
It's interesting. I think we've kind of evolved, and I think frankly the Trump era has been a part of this evolution where this transitive property politics, right? Like, you're a friend of this person and this person believes this thing, so you're responsible for their beliefs. I kind of think voters have weighed in on that and said, that is not a disqualifying factor in the way it used to be on the Republican or the Democratic side. Sean, one thing I'm interested in is, I appreciate you trying to say the disagreement was about the Michigan Senate race. I don't actually think that that's what JD was referring to. I think there were some other disagreements that the vice president might have been talking about that he didn't want to give voice to.
About Tucker's views on Russia, for example, or
the
Israel.
War in Iran, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, again, I think, you know, from my perspective, I think we've seen Tucker go in, frankly, a pretty strange direction from his days on Fox News, lately calling for the president to be removed from office, which is, frankly, a sort of crazy thing to be advocating for. So I don't think it's surprising to see the vice president disagree with him about whether the president should continue to serve.
Someone who always has interesting things to say is Stephen A. Smith. He had some thoughts on J.D. Vance, other potential 2028 contenders. The sports commentator telling Politico he does not plan on running for president himself after flirting with a bid, but he offered these thoughts on some other potential candidates. Take a listen.
Why do I bring up Josh Shapiro? Not only has he done a damn good job in the state of Pennsylvania, it's against a Republican legislature. And I'm thinking about the fact that he has to go across the aisle, Marco Rubio all day, every day, compared to J.D. Vance. Vice President Vance is certainly no dummy. And we've seen evidence of that on several occasions. He definitely outclassed Tim Walz in the vice presidential debate before the election. Give him credit for that. But I think that he's an individual that tries to be too like Trump.
Interesting that he brought up Josh Shapiro.
10 years ago, I wouldn't have taken a bet that we would have done a segment on Stephen A. Smith talking about his political future and weighing in on the Democratic presidential field. And I think that that tells you that in 2028, there will be room for an iconoclastic, independent, outside of the political system candidate, probably in both political parties, to be honest with you.
No question. Sean Cooksey, Joel Payne, thank you so much. Have a great Labor Day weekend, both of you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And happy Thursday, everyone. This is The Takeout, the Daily Report. Is coming up next. See you then.
The critically acclaimed series, Colin from Accounts, returns for a brand new season.
But what is it?
We're friends.
We are togetherly.
We're friendly together.
With a dog.
Colin from Accounts, new season, streaming September 10th, only on Paramount+.